From Wall Street to the Bitcoin frontier. Today, we sit down with John Arnold, principal at 1031, to talk Bitcoin as a monetary technology, long-term investment strategy, and what's next for global adoption. Let's dive in. As a reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only. If you enjoyed the content we produce, please remember to like, share, or comment, as this all helps us greatly.
This isn't for everyone. It's for the ones who know the old system is broken and are ready to build something that lasts. Welcome to the Build with Bitcoin podcast.
I'm co-host Israel Munoz, and joined with co-host Lynn Bairstow. Today we have the pleasure of welcoming John Arnold, principal at 1031, one of the leading investment platforms in the Bitcoin ecosystem. John, we're big fans of 1031. You guys have been pioneers on investing in Bitcoin companies, so it's a pleasure to have you on the podcast. Welcome, first of all.
Yeah, thanks a lot, guys. Great to be here.
Well, we have plenty to unpack in today's conversations. We'll do our best to get into a lot of interesting topics. You guys have a unique lens into the industry as well, John. Before getting into all of that, it'd be great to get to know you a little bit, as brief or not, that you want to get into your background and what got you into Bitcoin before 1031.
Yeah, for sure. So I come from a traditional finance background before kind of coming to Bitcoin full time. I grew up as in the wake in the shadow of the financial crisis. So got very interested in the nature of money, the nature of the financial system, monetary policy, and all that fairly early on in high school and college. Was a Ron Paul diehard for a long time, still am. And so it was a gold bug as I was kind of growing up and learning about just the nature of the system. And, you know, with that background, you would think that I would have grokked Bitcoin much more quickly than I did. But as with many stubborn gold bugs, it took me a little while to really get it. But I left college with those priors in mind and joined Goldman Sachs to do investment banking in 2015. Was an analyst there for a couple of years, did what is a fairly traditional and well-carved path, the boot camp that is. And then in 2017, left Goldman to join Citadel. I'd always been very interested in public markets, equity investing, analyzing companies, figuring out, you know, what makes them tick, what makes a durably good company, what makes a durably bad company. And, you know, expressing basically those theses through public markets bets. And so it made a lot of sense for me to join Citadel, which is a large hedge fund, one of the largest long-short market-neutral hedge funds. Was there for several years, went to another shop as well for a couple of years. And in the middle of that period, 2020 happened. So spring 2020 happened. And I was at home like all of us. And I'm sure you've gotten versions of this story from many guests previously, but was doing a lot of reading, looking at the state of the world, looking at the state of the Fed's balance sheet, and kind of the unprecedented fiscal and monetary policy choices that were being made. And, you know, just really sent me down a paranoid rabbit hole about the sustainability of the system we were living under. I can't exactly remember what set of Twitter threads or Twitter users ultimately kind of got me to take a second look at Bitcoin. But sometime in that spring, I was pulled down a rabbit hole. And that's when I really started to take it seriously, just given the extremity of what was going on. It was kind of some shock therapy for me to some degree. And, you know, spent a good amount of time, as one does, reading intensively, thinking, listening to every podcast under the sun, annoying my wife with nonstop conversation about Bitcoin, and kind of came out on the other side of that with high conviction that, you know, there was clear signal here and that Bitcoin could offer a variety of unprecedented solutions potentially to a lot of the problems that the sclerotic, decaying, you know, monetary system that we live under was facing. So I stayed in my hedge fund seat for a couple of years, just, you know, remaining a really interested Bitcoiner, just pleb, listening to podcasts, primarily Marty Bent and Matt O'Dell's podcasts for several years. And as a result of that, in kind of late 21, I was kind of looking around for ways to get more involved in investing in the space and finding interesting companies to invest in. Again, still in my hedge fund seat. And I realized that 1031 had just kind of come public and that Matt and Marty had joined the team. So I reached out through kind of a friend of a friend, got in contact with them, and just started having conversations with them on the side, doing some, you know, random side projects, helping them look at things and think about various things just in my spare time. And ultimately was able to kind of come on full time to the team in summer of 2022, which was an interesting time to join as well that we can get into. But it's been a great run since then. Really proud of, you know, what we've scaled up and developed so far. For those who are not familiar with 1031, as was mentioned, you know, we're one of the largest funds in the space, invested across the ecosystem, deployed over $200 million into some of the best companies in the space, have large investments in companies like Strike, which we can talk about. And, you know, just proud of all of that track record that we've put up so far for the past 4 years since I joined. And, you know, hoping to continue to help the team and help the ecosystem in whatever way I can with, you know, the background that I have from traditional finance. Cause I think there's still, you know, we're in not even really the top of the first inning of, durably and sustainably bridging traditional finance to Bitcoin and vice versa.
John, you know, I also come from a traditional financial background, worked with Merrill Lynch and in, managed portfolios. Do you feel that having that background and specifically dealing with a hedge fund, I mean, the hedge fund trading philosophy is much different than certainly, I mean, than, you know, traditional VC, but certainly now Bitcoin VC, where you're actually talking about longer term plays. How do you think about, how did you adopt your analytical background to adjust to this different way of thinking in investing in companies? And was it a hard leap, or were you kind of prepared for it when you made the decision to leave your seat in hedge fund trading? But I'd love to just hear about your thought process on that.
Yeah. I mean, I'll say it wasn't surprised to see some of the differences that, you know, I knew I'd be encountering. As you kind of reference generally, you know, the time horizon of any kind of, the life cycle and time horizon of an investment that a hedge fund is making is quite a bit shorter. It's in, you know, publicly traded, generally like liquid investments that you're can be whipping around quite frequently. So it's definitely a different philosophy in a lot of ways than something that looks more like venture capital. We can maybe talk about whether that label is necessarily fully appropriate for what 1031 does. But, you know, just as a for shorthand, certainly they're different. I would say at least at in kind of the way that I was trained, and I think the way that, you know, the best market neutral shops operate now, which is the vast majority of, or at least a huge plurality of hedge fund capital has in the last 10 years gone into those platforms. So it's, you know, shops like Citadel, Millennium, Point72 that people have probably heard of. You know, they've gotten a, you know, huge, accrued a huge amount of capital, in the last 10 years. And those shops tend to operate, you know, at least the fundamental equities book side of things, at least the training that I had and all the peers that I interacted with generally structured their process in a way that was a combination of like very short-term oriented, but based on, you know, very deeply kind of fundamentally informed understanding of industries. It's very like inch wide, mile deep. So you have, you know, I for example, was a subsector specialist in not just healthcare, but medical devices within healthcare. And you've got these teams of analysts and portfolio managers that are sector specialists and then subsector specialists that are focusing, you know, just on you know, one particular tiny kind of cross section of the economy, with the idea being like, you're going to try to be the axe in that particular subsector. And so the returns that you generate, you know, the expectation is that you're going to be, right. You know, hopefully if you do it well, you'll be right just a little more often than you're wrong. But when you pair that with, this market neutral risk framework of kind of trying to isolate, through various different portfolio construction techniques, you're trying to isolate everything except effectively the idiosyncratic performance of just the subsector, that the companies in the subsector that you cover, which theoretically you should know better than anyone else because that's all you're spending your time on, right? If you can do all that well, then the output is that you leverage your deep and specific knowledge of just this subsector to generate returns, which requires kind of deeply understanding the fundamentals of that particular sub-industry and the set of companies, right? So there was a lot of emphasis on that kind of fundamental analysis that I think is core to also the process that we employ at 1031. There's definitely way more data that you can employ on a company that's publicly traded and has been, has been publicly traded for 50 years and has, decades of financial filings to go back and look at. So that process looks very different, but I think the intuitions guiding both are similar in ways people might not expect. At the end of the day, you're trying to develop deep fundamental conviction about the direction that a company is going to be taking, that its market is going to be taking. What are its ultimate kind of competitive advantages that secure above average returns or not? Right? How might those change? What are the risk factors that could influence the way that those take shape? So there's a lot. All that is just to say, there's a lot of fundamental thinking that I think I have ported over from my last jobs. And, it again, the set of data that you have to do that is definitely more limited, and it requires more kind of thinking and more imaginative thinking of where something could go. And obviously you see companies as well that get in, 1 or 2 years to their early life cycle and completely pivot, right? And, now the investment that you made is, the thesis underlying that investment has totally changed. And so you don't see that as much in public markets. But in any case, at the original underwriting of an investment, I think in both seats, you are fundamentally trying to figure out, is this a good business or not? Does it have the potential to be a good business or not? And is it priced appropriately at the current round or at the current stock price to reflect both the quality that it may ultimately have and all of the risks that could, derail that story, basically?
Thanks, John. From what I hear from you, I largely agree that there's a lot of just fundamental analysis that's a bit of a copy paste. And it translates into, many industries and stages on both ends. I think both the builder and the investment side. So my experience is more on the startup and builder side. And I think that line of thinking applies as well. Ultimately as an entrepreneur, you're, regardless of the industry you're tapping into, you're looking for, where is an unmet need? Where are the problems and how do I provide a solution? If you're on the investment side of the equation, to your point, you're looking at pretty similar fundamental analysis of the points you just mentioned. So I think the good news is there for anyone who's looking to get into the Bitcoin industry from the outside, whether it's from the investment or the builder side, it's perfectly doable. However, the big, I think the massive opportunity, which most people still don't understand, is the size of that market, right? So even if you're, transitioning from solving a solution in the fiat world to the Bitcoin world, fundamentally, yeah, you're just trying to solve problems. And on the investment side, you're doing the same fundamental analysis, but the massive gap there is people still haven't woken up to the size of this market, right? And you wrote a fascinating piece called Bitcoin is Eating the World that kind of touches on this point that still, I would argue the vast majority of people don't quite grasp. And that's how big of a revolution or industry this is. Can you touch on, both your personal and as 1031, your views on this?
The basic kind of thrust of that piece, and I think that thesis, is the title of it was ripped from, people probably recognize Software is Eating the World, the Mark Andreessen piece from I think 2010, which it's interesting because it's by the time that he wrote that, it was kind of saying something that was pretty obvious. But either way, that was an influential piece, and that's kind of what I was pulling from. And I think the idea there in that piece, and I don't know if he says it exactly explicitly, but that the internet and internet connected computers have basically dematerialized one of the main primitives of social interaction, right? So suddenly you're collapsing to zero the marginal cost of transmitting information, of communicating things. And that that primitive, reducing those marginal costs to zero for something that was that socially important, had ripple effects into basically every industry, right? So ultimately, he goes through a bunch of different examples in that piece. And then, you've had 100x that number of examples since that piece was written of all the ways that software and the dematerialization of information transmission and, the turning information transmission into something instant affected all these different industries and verticals, and then different things were built on the first wave software companies that you couldn't have built the second wave without the first wave, and et cetera. So you just have kind of this compounding flywheel effect of that single basic primitive change in human social interaction. And I think the only other primitive in human society that is kind of as fundamental as something like language and communication is money, right? It's the only way that we, have been able to scale to anything like the levels that we've achieved over the last 2,000 years is through different forms of higher and lower quality types of monies. But that's a core primitive to the way that we do anything at scale. And so the interesting thing about Bitcoin is I think it really parallels a lot of the things that Andreessen was pointing out in that piece. And I think it's complementary in a lot of ways, where you finally have cash final settlement of monetary value that can be done instantly without a trusted third party and on a basis of a ledger that no one controls and that has the first ever instantiation of digital scarcity, right? And true finite provable scarcity at that. And so that is to say, better money on pretty much every metric that you would care about other than the fact that it's very new, right? And as many critics, I'm sure, will point out that it's volatile, right? In these early days of its adoption. But the key kind of intuition that I was pulling out in that piece is that is such a radically fundamental transformation in this key human primitive of social organization that it's going to have the same type of downstream impact across verticals. It's going to create new verticals because there's no company that, just like there's no company that didn't rely on and leverage in some way communication and information transfer. There's no company that is not touched by money and the nature of the type of monetary system that it's operating in. It's kind of the water that you swim in. And so there's going to be, and we're already seeing kind of the early stages of that, that impact, those ripple effects kind of playing out across different verticals of the economy. It's not going to hit every single industry, every single vertical simultaneously in the same way. And I talk in the piece about, you can think about concentric circles, expanding outward of certain industries. Payments or financial services are very obviously the first to be kind of, the first applications of a new monetary technology, certainly energy infrastructure as well with the mining angle that we can get into. And then you can see it expanding further and further out. But the idea is basically this theme represents a general TAM which is to say total addressable market, that's comparable in size to the TAM that was created by fundamentally changing the nature of information transfer. And so I think it's something that's completely consensus now for software and for internet connected software. And I think even by 2010, when Andreessen put that out, it was pretty consensus. But I think that everything I just said is far from consensus currently. We're in, I used the baseball inning analogy before, but I think we're in the warm up of the first inning for that narrative and that understanding to really percolate through certainly Wall Street and certainly just a mainstream investor consensus. But I do think that the market for Bitcoin linked technology, we can get into what that means, but Bitcoin-oriented technology and infrastructure is vast and vastly underappreciated as well.
Lynn and I are partners at Baselayer Advisors, where we use our network of venture capital partners and startup founders to connect investors with unique opportunities within the Bitcoin innovation space. Alongside this, we help startup founders with their growth and fundraising. Visit our website's advisory section to learn more.
I see that the evolution of that adoption will take place on an industry-specific basis, or do you think it'll be more geographically driven? Do you think there are use cases, you brought up financial services and energy, but remittances is obviously a really easy one, but also anyone working in a global supply chain for settlement. But do you feel that, but we also see that sometimes it's harder for people in with Western backgrounds and traditional financial systems at work to understand the potential and of what the internet protocol can facilitate. So how do you think about that in terms of industries versus geographies?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And I kind of think increasingly there's like this barbell effect where there's the old joke that, you know, the thief robs a bank and they ask him, you know, why did you rob the bank? Why did you rob this bank? And he says, well, that's where the money was, right? So there's an element of that with Bitcoin adoption, right? And the growth of Bitcoin as like a savings asset and a commercial asset in various different ways. Like part of it is it's going to go where the money is. And like the money is largely in like Western developed markets. I think there are a lot of people in those markets that have priors and exist in a system where, you know, it's hard to get someone to understand something that, when his paycheck depends on him not understanding it. There are a lot of people who have a paycheck that depends on them not understanding everything that we're talking about here. And that's fine. That'll change over time. But I do think there are very intelligent, very intrepid people within where the money is who have seen this and are seeing this and are in a position to understand like why this is fundamentally interesting and important. And it doesn't take that many of them to like push things forward. It takes like, you know, a couple dozen like high leverage, relatively powerful people in traditional finance to move a lot of capital and do a lot of things that can be very influential. Certainly we saw Larry Fink, you know, becoming the Bitcoin podcaster extraordinaire over the last couple of years after dumping on Bitcoin for a decade. He's an example, right, of a high leverage person in the pool of like where the money is. And I think that's going to continue. You're seeing that with sovereign wealth funds as well. Increasingly, a couple of university endowments have started to dip a toe in. So you've got people who are in position in that pool to understand it. I think that's moving forward, and we can get into that further. But I think that's realistically, that's going to be a big driver of continued mainstreaming of Bitcoin. Then the other end of the barbell is, I think, exactly what you're saying, where Bitcoin is more interesting to people in countries where just the savings base is on a national level lower. It's less of a savings asset and more of an ability to get around authoritarian regimes or to escape hyperinflation or to just leverage the Bitcoin rail and the Lightning Network, for example, for remittances to do something and to solve a problem that isn't necessarily forward looking in the sense of trying to build out a portfolio or a particular savings base, but to just leverage Bitcoin today for what its native properties enable in a way that nothing else can really offer. And I think that is certainly, that's the other kind of end of this, you know, the opposite end of like the socioeconomic like distribution of resources is, I think, the other kind of wedge to where we're seeing clear appreciation of what Bitcoin can offer and provide. It is naturally going to like command less capital and probably have on like a, you know, day-to-day, year-to-year basis, less effect on what the world sees as Bitcoin adoption, which is mostly like the KPI people care about for that is Bitcoin price. Like it's probably not going to move price that much today, but I do think that on a use case basis, that is really like where you see per capita, like the most day-to-day use of Bitcoin. And as call it a medium of exchange or, you know, a tool that does something for you today, tangibly. And so I think it's both. And I think we want to invest in interesting businesses on both ends of that spectrum. I think probably like the big middle gets carried along by like those two ends, basically, right? And like those are the forces that increasingly make Bitcoin like more and more mainstream and more kind of woven into society and like daily social interaction. And that those are like the big drivers that I think that, you know, we should be focusing on.
And you know, so far we haven't touched on this, but I think it's important to just kind of bring up and frame it as well, John, the fact that you guys are, of course, Bitcoin only. And you know, when I was listening to you earlier with the parallels to what internet and software did to information, Bitcoin is doing to money. And that's all very true. I think part of the reason why it's maybe even harder to grasp, I mean, to your point, 2010, it was already when that piece, Software is Eating the World, came out, it was more or less already consensus, but you mentioned it yourself, and I agree, Bitcoin is still far from being a consensus, right? It's still a concept that's a bit hard for people to grasp. And I think part of it is because there's maybe two layers to it. It's not only the obvious technological upgrade of, you know, suddenly having peer-to-peer global money. You can transact instantly without these intermediaries. That's one side of the equation. But then the other piece of it, which is equally important, is this whole, you know, scarcity component of Bitcoin and the immutability of the supply schedule. And that's, I think, maybe the deeper topic that most people haven't or don't immediately, you know, think about. The money itself before was broken. So that has, of course, just vast, vast, vast implications. And that's, I believe, I don't know if you agree or not, John, but I believe that's why there's been also just this attraction and hype with, you know, general blockchain, because that's an easier concept to understand, right? And that's why people maybe end up gravitating towards these other token projects and other private blockchains. And they think about it through the lens of just the technological upgrade, right? What I want to get to is, can you explain to the listener who's maybe not as familiar with these fundamental massive differences between Bitcoin and the rest of crypto, why, of course, 1031 focuses on Bitcoin specifically?
Yeah, for sure. I think it's a good insight. And there's an element of, you know, if you're familiar with like the David Foster Wallace story about the two fish swimming around, and, you know, I can't remember how he exactly presents it, but the essence of the story is that the fish are not able to understand that they are swimming in water. The concept of water as what they are in, that defines every like realm or parameter of their existence. They're just like, they're not able to get outside the system and then look back into it, you know, externally. So it's like the question of like, what is water? What is the water that you're swimming in? And I think that relates to this conversation insofar as when people, from the perspective, from the water of the system we've been living in for the last 50 to 100 years, you know, and whether you want to define it as the post kind of Federal Reserve era or the post 1971 petrodollar, post gold standard era, whatever it is, anyone who's kind of in the workforce today, anyone who's allocating capital today is swimming around in this water of a monetary system that fundamentally, you know, is built on a constantly growing monetary base, where the idea of, you know, a scarce unit that defines economic interaction is completely foreign. And most people, like, it's been a reasonably functional system for at least the people who kind of live in it. So you're not really incentivized to ask kind of how any of it works, or if there are downsides to it, or if there are any other ways to potentially do it, or how did it evolve historically. And so people end up, you're right, to your point, looking at things like Bitcoin or things like other blockchains and thinking, okay, well, the key thing I need to focus on here is this is like a technology play. It's like, it's a different type of technology, a different way to do things. And, you know, maybe it's comparable to the internet insofar as it's a technology, right? So, okay, I'll look at it as like some sort of, you know, technology thesis. And, they end up not evaluating the much more important element of it, which is that it's a fundamental change, you know, to the extent it gains adoption, to the extent that it works, continues to do what it's trying to do. It is not just technology, but a monetary technology, right? And it has therefore implications for the unit of account that you're using to even make technology investments of any kind in the first place, right? So that's not like well understood. And I think that's a tough leap for people to make, because it requires you to kind of like analyze what water is, like what the water is that you're swimming in. And I think for those that do that and go down that rabbit hole, I think you find a lot of people like us on this podcast, the guests that you often have, who, if they run down that trail, you know, they, I think, generally walk into certain conclusions, like money is effectively a winner take all, or at least winner take most race. Everything competes for liquidity. We're constantly dealing with, you know, effectively an A/B test of what asset do I want to hold. And generally people will gravitate more and more to holding, you know, the better asset that preserves more value for them over time, that they can use to trade with more people, or that they expect to be able to use to trade with more people over time. Kind of these Misesian, Mengerian insights that are, I think, well represented in Austrian economics, that led to originally gold to become what it was, which is, you know, for 5,000 plus years, this universally accepted, both medium of exchange, but also store value, this kind of monetary base layer. When you run down those rabbit holes and you come out on the other side, and if you're honest, and if you look at all of the literature and think it through, you'll find that generally this is kind of a winner take all race, and that if Bitcoin is, and if other crypto assets on other blockchains are, effectively, they have to compete as money, which I think that they do. There's no reason, there's no way for ultimately the incentive mechanics to function if the endogenous unit on any given blockchain is not a monetary asset that can endogenously incentivize activity. If that's the case, then the most scarce, the most credibly scarce asset with the biggest network effect and the earliest lead time to establish that network effect that becomes harder and harder to displace every day, is most likely to win out that race and is likely to, you know, become, and is more and more likely every day to become and remain kind of the dominant monetary technology for the whole world. And so that leads you to a conclusion where you say, that's where the vast majority of the economic value is likely going to accrue. You know, money as a market, to get back to our TAM discussion, money as a market is, you know, orders of magnitude bigger than any other market. Even if you think that Ethereum or Solana can be some kind of interesting tech play, if you throw out everything that I say about kind of the nature of these things having to compete as money, and you think that Ethereum will be this interesting rail for XYZ thing, a world computer, whatever it may be, you know, you quickly have to look at that TAM and relative to the TAM for money and realize that, you know, it's completely outmatched, right? And so all of that leads you to a conclusion where you say, that's what I should be focusing my time on. As an individual allocator, I should be focusing on kind of getting as much Bitcoin as I can. But as an investor in any of these ecosystems, I think you also want to be investing where you want to be skating where the puck is going, and you want to be investing where the economic mass is accruing. And if you look at what Bitcoin has done relative to all of the other kind of broader crypto universe over its entire history, it has pulled in, you know, significantly more capital than the next top 10 cryptos combined. And I think based on everything I said, it'll continue to do that. And so that just leads you to the natural conclusion of, if I want to invest in any of these ecosystems, I want to invest in the winner. I want to back the winning horse, and I want to go where the puck is going and where the economic mass is going. And so that's a long-winded way of saying, that's how we got to our thesis at 1031, right? We want to invest in the monetary technology and the kind of the associated, let's say, freedom technologies, if you want to call it that, of the future, right? Any Bitcoin and anything that advances Bitcoin or leverages Bitcoin puts us in a position of, you know, basically riding the strongest wave, strapping ourselves to the rocket of adoption of the strongest monetary technology that the world has to offer. And, you know, that puts us in a position to ideally deliver outsized returns to investors. So, beyond ideology, beyond any other points we can make that are valid, I think just from a self-interested ROI perspective, that's why we do what we do. And that's why we focus on what we focus on relative to, you know, other kind of digital asset verticals that are, you know, much smaller in size than what we're looking at.
You referenced one of my absolute favorite pieces of writing, David Foster Wallace's This Is Water. And I think I reread it like every 6 months or something like that to remind myself, because I think at the center of that essay, which was a commencement speech, was the idea that, you know, we tend to be very self-centered in our awareness, and we look at things in the way that we've always seen them, you know, like, what is water? This is water. And 1031 has just done a great job of doing that, not only from the standpoint of where you're choosing to focus on, but can, you know, if we're looking outside of the most obvious things, and VC has had this formula for investing where they take a percentage of the company, they, you know, they increasingly fund the company or find partners to fund that company to accelerate its growth. And then the outcome for them is to sell that company to another buyer or to have a public exit of the company, which frankly may or may not be what the founder of the company wants. I think there's been this formulatic, you know, move fast and break things and growth at all costs that has infiltrated Silicon Valley thinking. So when 1031 decided to make these investments in the best financial protocol going forward, and I love the fact that 1031 resists being identified as a VC fund, but they call themselves an investment platform for Bitcoin companies. Can you elaborate a little bit more on the thinking inside of 1031, not only from the companies that you're invested in, but the way you approach investing in these companies, how you look at the time horizon of your partnership with those companies, and even how you communicate that and get investors from an LP standpoint? Because at the end of the day, a VC fund has to have its own investors that support your investment thesis. So would love to just see how you've stepped out of the water, looked at what the water is, and say, we want to do this differently.
Yeah, for sure. I think the first element that structures our thinking is that we are Bitcoiners, and anything that we do needs to be structured to outperform Bitcoin in the sense that it gives us a chance to have, you know, more Bitcoin tomorrow than we have today. And you know, that's a high hurdle to meet. But that right away, you know, that's what we aim to do with our funds. And that right away changes the way that you think about allocating capital and what opportunities make sense and the structures in which they make sense. But it also, like the other piece kind of related on the other side, is that we only invest in Bitcoiners, right? And people who have that same mentality, even if they're not really directly working in something that you would call like Bitcoin infrastructure classically. Like, we've got a bunch of different companies on that you can see on our portfolio website that are not, you would look at them and at first glance, they wouldn't be obviously like Bitcoin companies, but they're founded by Bitcoiners, by people who share that same attitude. And that's important because that really, when you have that view, it really changes your sense of opportunity cost. It changes your sense of the ROI that you must demand, the hurdle rate that you must demand on any capital that's being deployed into the business, into incremental headcount or marketing or any kind of growth investment you want to make. That could just be Bitcoin held in the corporate treasury, or it could be, you know, Bitcoin paid out to you as distributions ultimately as an owner of the company, whether an investor or kind of the founder. But you've got this high hurdle that you're dealing with constantly of outperforming Bitcoin with your capital investments. And equally, it gives you a different sense of how to manage runway and how to manage your expenses and forces you into a position where you want to get to, as a founder, being cash flow positive as soon as possible so that the business can stack Bitcoin again on the corporate balance sheet, make distributions so that you and your owners can stack Bitcoin, whatever the case may be. But you don't want to be spending years and years and a decade plus burning cash to, as you said, you know, drive growth at all costs in the hope that you know, one day maybe you can flip to profitability eventually, right? You've had, I think, 15 years, 15, 20 years really, of especially easy monetary policy that kind of ended a couple years ago, but maybe on the back end is still being, you know, facilitated in one way or another. But you've had this period where you've been able to kind of burn cash as a company indefinitely with the assumption that there will always be another funding round. There will always be someone who is ready to, as long as the revenue line is going up, as long as like your MAU number is going up, you know, there are a couple KPIs and someone can slap a multiple on that and buy it, either buy the company or come in and invest in the company at a valuation that's higher than what you got before. And I think we're seeing the start of that no longer being the case for a variety of reasons. But, you know, right away, if you're a Bitcoiner, that's like not how you think about it at all, right? You don't think about, let me assume that I can just, I'll burn as much capital as I need today. I can always get it back later. Like, you can't. Like, this Bitcoin is running away from you constantly. And you know, as we all know, it can go through its volatile periods. We're in a draw right now, but when it decides to move, it often moves very, very quickly to the upside as well. And if it continues to be what it is meant to be, there's only 21 million Bitcoin, and vast majority of them are not coming up for sale anytime soon. And so you don't have the luxury of just saying, I'll burn capital indefinitely, and you know, eventually I'll be able to return it. Every day that you delay profitability is a day that you move further and further away from being able to actually outperform Bitcoin and to be, you know, net positive in Bitcoin terms, whether you're just thinking of it as an investor or someone who's pouring kind of your time and your sweat equity into a company, right? And so all that is, like, collectively, radically changes the way that we think about allocating capital and the way that our founders think about using capital. And it just right away makes a lot of the VC frameworks from, you know, the 2000s and 2010s of spend as much as you can for the land grab. And, you know, we'll figure it out later. It makes them untenable, like, from the very get go. So that's the first like major structuring piece, I would say, to our philosophy that's very different than what you see anywhere else.
Yeah. And it's not an easy one. I mean, it sounds logical maybe when you explain it or when you listen to it, but it's actually tough for people to shift from the short term to the long-term thinking. There's very few that in practice are able to do that. I would even guess if you just did some, you know, some experiment of asking people, non-Bitcoiners necessarily, do you think in 150 years, what's more likely to still be around, the Bitcoin or the US dollar? I would think maybe a lot of people might even agree that, yeah, I could see actually Bitcoin being the one that's more likely, but Are you going to touch Bitcoin? Are you going to bet? Nah, that's sad. I don't know if I want to do that, because they're still kind of thinking, you know, we're just, I don't know if it's human nature or as a consequence of the broken fiat, you know, monetary system, we're still so trained to just think short term. And to your point, in VC, private equity, and, you know, many capital markets, it's just this race to quick returns. And ultimately behind that is the fact that you consciously or subconsciously know that you're purchasing power is slowly running away from you, right? And Bitcoin is radically changing that entire equation. So hats off to you guys, because in practice, that's not easy to actually, you know, kind of put your money where your mouth is. And you guys have done a fantastic job of building a large portfolio of these long-term thinking entrepreneurs and businesses. And to maybe a more controversial point, John, we're still in the early stages of this new technology and the Bitcoin protocol adoption. The store of value component of it, which is, of course, transformative, it is still quite volatile. And it can be challenging for startups to put their mind around, okay, so once I get this, I understand, you know, what Bitcoin is, what it does in the medium to long term, and I want to hold some of it in my treasury, and just to kind of strengthen my war chest, if you will, as a startup and as a builder. But in practice, it's a tough execution. And right now it's probably, you know, top of mind for many startups who maybe either previously allocated a portion of their treasury to Bitcoin, or even those who were thinking about it. It's in this moment of time with, you know, the price down 50% since its recent local top, it can be a tough exercise for people to kind of land on. And you have some great perspectives here on what are the most important points to consider: runway, timing. How have you seen the more successful companies in your portfolio actually in practice allocate to Bitcoin in a prudent way? I mean, can you shed some light on this topic of Bitcoin as a treasury asset for a startup? Because it's different, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think a few things. We've got a piece on 1031.xyz. If you look at our insights section from a couple of years ago about the Bitcoin treasury strategy, written by our co-founder, Grant Gillum. And the framing there, I think, is really good for at the time that we wrote it, you know, having a Bitcoin treasury strategy. I think this was in like late 23. So this was like not a thing to like have a strategy around Bitcoin treasuries, that, you know, it was like Saylor and nobody else. But we were thinking about it then from like an early stage company perspective, or like a mid stage growth company perspective. And we were seeing in practice that it was having a dedicated and systematic way to use Bitcoin as a treasury asset on the balance sheet for our companies had a lot of benefits if structured appropriately. And I think Grant frames it intelligently as like short, medium, and kind of long-term benefits. The short-term benefits were, we were coming that year off of SVB blowing up and almost wiping out, you know, every startup in the country, because that's where everyone was holding their liquid cash assets. And we had some companies that had money at SVB, but a lot of those same companies also had a Bitcoin treasury. And, you know, we were, you know, in the trenches with them over that weekend when SVB was blowing up. And it was talking about how they were all going to, if they had to, how are they going to meet payroll? How are they going to keep, you know, the lights on? And we saw the short-term benefit of a Bitcoin treasury was, okay, well, the banking system might completely implode on Monday morning, but you saw Bitcoin. You know, you saw this permissionless global asset and network that you can use to fund operations for some amount of time, right? So having it as a lifeboat in the case of, you know, what a week before that, everyone would have said it was like a completely like unrealistic scenario that basically like the banking system would almost collapse and like the Fed would essentially have to become the FDIC to make sure to backstop the entire thing or else the whole system would come crashing down. You know, in a situation like that, you in that tail risk scenario, you have an ability to keep things going for some amount of time, right? So that's the short-term benefit that we saw very directly. The kind of the medium-term benefit is we've also seen and had seen over the course of investing out of our funds, was that we've had several companies who, because of their Bitcoin treasury strategy, have not had to dilute themselves or us, you know, as much as they otherwise might have, right? To usually when you're, you know, a startup, an early stage company that you're not cash flow positive or not meaningfully cash flow positive. If you want to continue growing, there's kind of this established playbook of, okay, you raise a pre-seed round and then a year later or 6 months later, whatever, you raise a seed round. And then another year you raise a series A and then a series B and a series C. And you're just kind of doing this infinite kind of dilution hamster wheel to keep things going and to keep growing. And we've had several companies that basically just opted out of that entire flow because they allocated, you know, a chunk of their whatever their last raise was to Bitcoin, or because, you know, they were able to at least establish, because of the philosophy we discussed earlier, they were able to establish some level of even modest positive cash flow and sweep some profits into Bitcoin and kind of build that. And so that, you know, that combination of things allowed them to save themselves, you know, what is it like 10%, 20%, whatever dilution of the company. So that's kind of a medium term benefit. The long term benefit is kind of the one that everyone's familiar with, which is just like stack Bitcoin for the long term and your enterprise value grows eventually along with the Bitcoin. And that's, you know, that's very real. That's kind of obvious, but it's very real too over time. So those are the benefits that we've seen and the reason that we've been really active in recommending a Bitcoin treasury strategy for our companies for a long time. I think to your point on, you know, the success cases versus the cases where it doesn't work as well, you know, I think when it works really well, ideally you're budgeting the portion of the raise that you dedicate to Bitcoin. And some companies do, you know, quite a lot more than the other companies, but you're making that decision based on what are your likely, you know, fiat denominated liabilities over the next year or 2 years based on the growth trajectory of the company, the things you want to accomplish, the hiring you know you need to do that you can't avoid, the marketing that you know you need to do, the product investment you need to do. And making sure that you have the ability to meet as much of that as possible while also holding back some in Bitcoin. So just budgeting appropriately based on what realistic burn is probably going to look like in a bunch of different scenarios is a big piece of it. And then also, you know, generally trying not to buy local tops. I think it's something that we've all done. I have a personal rule that when we hit a new all-time high, I always buy a little bit because eventually it won't be the all-time high. Like eventually it will just run away from me and I'll be like, oh, that was the last time I could possibly buy that price. But in general, like full porting, at, you know, a time when we're at like the 99th percentile of a bunch of different on-chain metrics or something, is probably a good way to end up with some near-term reduction in purchasing power. So trying to, you know, time things such that maybe you DCA your corporate treasury allocation over a number of quarters or something to avoid hopefully buying putting yourself in a position where you cut off your runway too aggressively rather than, you know, benefit from Bitcoin's medium to long-term expansion and benefit your runway. So those are the things that I think have worked out. When it's worked out well, which has been in most cases, it's been, you know, a combination of just prudent kind of budgeting and being honest about what's a reasonable case for burn and, you know, not hopefully not FOMOing in the entire treasury right at a local top.
John, you guys are such forward thinkers in thinking about Bitcoin treasuries for startups and also the concept of sats flow and starting with the concept of getting to profitability and cash flow positive as soon as possible. Are you also rethinking what a typical investment deal looks like, you know, percentage of equity for investment? Are you doing anything with like convertibles or with repayment in Bitcoin or, and it may be even 1031 with, I think I'd heard Marty talk about, receiving a payback or a partial payback of a 1031 investment in a company in Bitcoin. But I just would love to think about, are you thinking in these creative ways about how you are actually structuring deals either with your startups or with your LPs?
Yeah. I mean, we've had companies pay us, Bitcoin dividends. That's definitely more the exception than the rule, but that is, something that we're very interested in, when that makes sense. I think we've experimented with a couple different things. Generally, there are definitely interesting structures that we've put into play, I think, with several of our different deals that are a little less conventional. But I think generally, it comes out more in from the perspective of if we're underwriting any deal that we do, any equity investment that we're making to Bitcoin and Bitcoin outperformance, the natural output of that is that the valuation has to be a certain level for the check size, right? We have to, have some level of exposure to the company for it to potentially make sense based on realistic kind of valuation pathways that we could see the company taking. So I would say more often than not, there definitely have been creatively structured scenarios. And I think that can continue. I think more often than not, it has manifested more as valuation discipline and trying to, just use the Bitcoin outperformance hurdle as kind of our North Star for what ultimately makes an investment make sense or not.
Well, John, I mean, we definitely want to be respectful of your time, but before we, begin wrapping up, I want to get your take on two of the more kind of controversial or critical angles going around in Bitcoin right now. Quantum slowing adoption. Is quantum, really a threat? Is Bitcoin still being adopted? Are its use cases dying? I think the three of us here probably agree on, no, it's not, adoption is not slowing and quantum isn't as big of a threat, at least personally. That's my belief, as you hear about in the internet. But I'd love your brief take on those topics that are in people's, mind right now.
Yeah, for sure. I think, so as it relates to kind of the quantum piece, we wrote about this early last year. So if you check out our website, there's kind of a deep dive into just the quantum question. I think to me, I approach it just as an investor. Like I used to, in my prior seat, I was looking at, I mentioned, med tech companies and companies in healthcare. And, on the device side, you don't see this as much as on the pharma side, but across healthcare, there's always black box risk. They're always whether it's new data that comes out from a clinical trial that's very hard to predict as a generalist, or even as a specialist, I'm certainly not an MD, I'm certainly not a PhD researcher, so I don't have, and most investors don't have unique insight there. And also with the way our healthcare system works is there's a very opaque labyrinth of reimbursement where certain devices get reimbursed a certain way 1 year and then suddenly next year that radically changes to the upside or to the downside. And that is the definition of a black box, and it's extremely difficult to have any real alpha calling that, right, without insider information. I kind of look at the quantum question the same way as it relates to the technical pieces of it. I think it's a little a waste of time to argue about and spend time parsing, is quantum coming in 2 years? Is it 5 years? Is it 10 years? Is it 20 years? And, I dive into these 10 different ResearchGate papers that say one thing or another. And, I had an LLM synthesize them and it said this thing about, it's likely coming in 8 years. Yeah, maybe, maybe not. I just look at it as a black box that I don't think almost anyone, including many people probably in the quantum computing industry, are in a great position to actually evaluate in an unbiased way, where it's actually going to go. So to me, it's what actually is the level of risk? Let's just assume it's some probability of happening. What is functionally the level of risk to Bitcoin? What are the ways to mitigate that? And I think, to be clear, you'll see if you go back and look at the piece, I do think there are a lot of reasons to be skeptical on a lot of more aggressive quantum timelines for a wide variety of reasons, for actually kind of scaling it up to what would be necessary to attack Bitcoin. But I think it's more interesting and what more overlooked to just ask, well, how prepared is Bitcoin? How prepared could Bitcoin be? I think one of the things that's misunderstood or underappreciated by a lot of people and generalists is they look at this as they see it as a black box too, but they're like, it's a black box for which there is effectively no solution. And if quantum happens, like that's it, kill shot, game over, Bitcoin's dead. And I think there's a lot of underappreciation of how much airplay this topic has gotten since the very early days of Bitcoin. Like if you go back and look at Bitcoin talk forums from, I think, as early as like 2010, this issue is discussed. And if you look at the Bitcoin OpTech newsletter, which is a great newsletter to subscribe to just to keep your head informed on, you know, what's going on in Bitcoin technical circles. If you look at their newsletter, the 2025 year in review summary, there's a ton of, you know, there are a ton of data points on different deep technical discussions among devs in the space who are, you know, working on different projects about quantum mitigation measures and things that Bitcoin could realistically do to deal with it. So all that is to say, like, we do have a lot of potential solutions for a, you know, for Q-Day happening, right? Regardless of how probable or improbable you expect it to be, there are a lot of solutions. Now, as the great economist Thomas Sowell said, there are no solutions, there are only trade-offs. And like all of those potential solutions have trade-offs. And so there is a legitimate question of, well, what kinds of trade-offs do we want to make and when do we want to make them as well? I think the first piece is just everyone should appreciate that a lot of work has already gone into thinking about this. This is not a fundamentally intractable problem. It's something that has a lot of different potential solutions and mitigation measures. It's just a question of what kinds of trade-offs do you want to make to get there? And also what kinds of solutions could emerge over the next few years, right? Like there's nothing saying that work on this is stopping. And if anything, I think it's certainly accelerating. And so what kinds of neat cryptography tricks will the load-bearing cryptography people, you know, there's the phrase, the load-bearing internet person that keeps the internet running. There's load-bearing cryptography people, the wizards out there. What are they going to come up with potentially in the next few years of more research that could actually eliminate some of those trade-offs potentially? So I think it's a black box that, you know, we can debate the probability of, but it has a lot of potential solutions already at play. The last thing I would say about it too, that I think is radically underemphasized in the conversation is, you know, Bitcoin is money for enemies. And that requires, you know, it assumes and requires a level of adversarial thinking in everything that we do with it, all the ways that you personally use your Bitcoin and what you expose it to, and also the system itself, the types of changes that collectively everyone using Bitcoin is willing to accept at a protocol level. We need to have a degree of adversarial thinking. And it's not necessarily my base case, but if I were a state actor and I wanted to disrupt Bitcoin, one of the most capital efficient ways that I can think of to do that would be to introduce relatively new and untested cryptography, and then to say, then to stir up a kerfuffle that made people using Bitcoin desperate to introduce those new and untested cryptographic assumptions to the system. Satoshi chose ECDSA, the signature algorithm that governs Bitcoin signatures, which is the thing that would be at risk theoretically in a quantum attack. He chose that. There were other things that he could have chosen. He chose that because it was both the most lightweight thing that had also had the most kind of real world battle testing. And I think that's the mindset that we need to adopt when thinking about changing something as basic as cryptographic assumptions in Bitcoin, because I'm pretty sure that if we're right in any way about what Bitcoin can be for the world, there are state actors that are interested in making sure that that does not happen, right? That it gets disrupted in some way. And there's always a risk with new cryptography of unevaluated or poorly understood potential for backdoors or vulnerabilities. And that would kill Bitcoin, right? That's the end of Bitcoin, right? If suddenly there's new cryptography that isn't well evaluated or well understood that breaks the way that it works and that we assume that it can work. And so I would just say, like, there's a risk of doing nothing. There's a risk of dismissing quantum entirely to the point that no one does any work on it. And, you know, you do get surprised in 5 years or 10 years or 20 years, whatever advances in quantum computing that can compromise Bitcoin signatures. There is equally a risk in doing something too fast and doing the wrong thing. And I think humanity has this action bias of there might be a problem. We have to do something now. And, you know, you see this across history. We've seen it certainly in various iterations over the last, you know, 5 or 10 years in, you know, certainly in the US. And I just, that's a piece of the conversation that I think is underappreciated and under-discussed, that there's risk of doing something and doing the wrong thing, right? So that's essentially my view on the quantum piece. If you're an investor trying to evaluate it, you know, there's a lot of work that's being done, that has been done. There are solutions that can be put into place. I think we can probably come up with better solutions too over the next several years. But we also shouldn't be agitating for quick adoption of novel cryptography just because of kind of a black box risk. And finally, I know I've gone on a long time here on this quantum rant, but the last thing I would say is I don't think it's credible to say that this is the thing that's, you know, Bitcoin went from 125K to 65K because everyone suddenly realized that quantum could be a thing. Like, I think there are many, many, many more credible explanations. The vast majority of institutional investors, like, are still getting their head around, you know, what is a blockchain? Like, what is the difficulty adjustment? Yes, quantum is like yet another headline that they'll have to think through, but I think there's very little incremental selling that has happened in Bitcoin because of recent headlines about quantum computing. I think that's looking at price action that already happened and trying to graft a narrative onto it and trying to find a reason for it. So, all right, end of quantum rant.
And I want to point out that you guys have a weekly newsletter, the 1031 timestamp, which I'm an avid reader of. And I think if you've enjoyed what John has been talking about here in quantum, you do some deep dive pieces in the research, and this is all on the 1031 website that we'll reference. You know, honestly, I think one of the reasons Israel and I respect 1031 as much as we do is you're not just investing in the Bitcoin ecosystem, but you're also really thinking deeply about it, and you're identifying trends, you're identifying, you know, potential threats or what's going on in the market, and you're looking at where this new global financial technology is heading, you know, where the puck is going. So for anyone interested in tracking that as well, just really encourage you to sign up for the 1031 timestamp. Israel, I'm sorry, I think.
No worries. I was just going to ask real quickly, John, on the adoption, what are you seeing based on your portfolio companies, slowing, accelerating?
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends on the vertical you're talking about. In general, I would say like year on year, like it's kind of just up and to the right. The price action, I think, hurts and helps different types of businesses. You know, businesses that have like exchange capabilities, like you have seen a lot of volume, right? When you have volatility to the upside or to the downside. So, you know, you see a lot more activity even in the last few months out of some of those businesses. I would say the businesses that generally are seeing kind of like the most adoption driven tailwinds are those that best integrate Bitcoin into people's lives and existing kind of financial stacks and give them the ability to move Bitcoin further and further to effectively like top of wallet status, right? So whether that's like Strike or Fold or Unchained, you know, companies that are just providing like the picks and shovels of Bitcoin financial services, you know, that's like an up and to the right kind of story with all of them in terms of like the metrics you care about in terms of, you know, user growth and user activity. And then the other kind of big area, I think, of tailwinds for like adoption is the energy angle that, you know, we haven't talked about much here, but we've been well before it was popular in Silicon Valley to be an energy maximalist and to, you know, adopt the framework that there is no such thing as an energy poor rich society. You know, we were saying that back in 2020, 21, 22. When the main concern on everyone's lips was, you know, ESG and kind of reducing power usage and kind of having less of an electricity footprint, right? Like now it's completely flipped the other way because of AI. But Bitcoiners have been on that train for a very long time, obviously, because of Bitcoin's link to real world energy use through proof of work. We've understood, you know, the value of that and the importance of that. And I think that has just continued like apace, kind of regardless of price, both because of the load balancing thesis for grid systems. So kind of grid connected miners and infrastructure providers for that use case, as well as oil field and kind of off-grid infrastructure providers that are deploying Bitcoin mining in oil and gas. And then increasingly, you've seen that growth regardless of price action, but also increasingly everyone's very aware of the only story right now in the mainstream financial press is AI and HPC. And there's been clear synergy between the companies that have set up infrastructure to run, you know, data centers for Bitcoin mining. You know, they've seen massive tailwinds for HPC as well. And a lot of our companies have been able to benefit from that too. And that came from, again, like that is not directly like a Bitcoin centric story. A company like Giga Energy, you know, has done amazing work. And, you know, if you go check out their Twitter feed, you'll see everything that they've, the ways that they've accelerated in the last year or so. They were in the position to cater to a lot of that new demand because they understood from first principles the importance of, you know, solid energy infrastructure and that the world was going to have much, much more of it. And the ways that Bitcoin could play into that. And now increasingly, you know, how that factors into the HPC story. So I think that's the other like big adoption story that I think is maybe not as consensus or well understood by like a mainstream allocator. I think they probably think of adoption as like more people holding Bitcoin or more people spending Bitcoin. And yeah, I think we are seeing that, but we're also seeing like the Bitcoin's tremendous utility value as this energy sink, this power sink across the world in the United States. So that's another, I think, key adoption story that is going to be huge for our portfolio, but also just for space in general over the next, you know, couple of years.
Well, very well put, John. And Lynn and I, in a different way, I mean, we're not investing in the space like you guys are, you know, actively, but we do get to speak to a lot of businesses, startups and entrepreneurs. And yeah, I mean, I think what's going on behind the scenes is a bit mind blowing. There's a lot happening, and a lot of the infrastructure that will be used in the near future, I think, is being actively built now. So yeah, it's adoption's definitely a bit more of a vector. But I mean, just want to thank you for your time, John. I mean, this has been, you know, we certainly hope the listeners have gotten as much out of it as Lynn and I certainly have. And before we, you know, kind of hand things off, where can people also get in touch, whether it's a startup wondering if you guys are active as a fund, whether it's an, you know, potential LP?
Yeah, for sure. If you check out our webpage, 1031.xyz/funds, you can see some information on the active funds that we have. Like I said, we've raised and deployed over $200 million up to this point, and are in the middle of our third fund right now. So you can take a look at some detail there. And you know, we're on Twitter, we're on Noster. You can find me personally at JohnArnold1031 on Twitter and primal.net/John. You post a good deal there. And I think if you check out our insights page as well at 1031.xyz, you'll find, you know, years of writing that we've been doing. Often feels like shouting into the void, but hopefully if this conversation has been interesting, some of that will be interesting to you as well.
Thank you again, John. Really enjoyed this conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks a lot for having me, guys.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Build with Bitcoin. If you found it of value, please take a second to like, subscribe, or share. This helps the visibility and reach of our podcast so that more people are aware of the innovation happening in and around Bitcoin. It truly means a lot. I'd also like to take this opportunity to invite you to join us at an event that Israel and I are hosting, Meet to Tech Talks 2026, taking place from October 25th to the 27th at the exclusive Punta Mita Resort in Mexico. This will be an intimate gathering of 125 invite-only participants exploring how the future of capital is being shaped by the intersection of Bitcoin, artificial intelligence, and energy. To request an invite or for more information, visit mitatechtalks.com. We hope you'll join us. And thanks again for being a part of the Build with Bitcoin community.